Welcome to Semiobites, bite-sized podblog episodes related to theological semiotics.
Hi there, you're listening to a multi-part episode, so be sure to tune in and subscribe to catch all of this series of episodes to fully experience this topic.
And somebody gaslighted me behind the scenes and contacted their tech team and pulled a little thing out of context and said, he can't say this, it violates this principle. And the guy just pulled my ID and then sent me an email and said, because you said this in one of your posts, your ID's been pulled. That was the straw that broke the camel. That's the point where I said, you know, they're not going to make it, because the split over Hallam has divided the group. The movement has split it right down the middle. And I'm with Hallam. I know full well that those fascist capitalist oligarch bastards are laughing up their sleeves at how easily they could pull this off with just a little bit of a media manipulation. And that's exactly what happened. Sven said he was surprised that Die Zeit, which is ordinarily a very good progressive piece of source of journalism, he said this was way out of their normal mode of reporting. He said it was really surprising to him that it was so one-sided and that it was so inflammatory in terms of going against Hallam so quickly and so sharply. He said that's not their normal journalism. Well, what does that tell you? That tells you somebody got to them. I mean, likely. Yeah. I have no evidence. There never is evidence, but that's quite likely. But anyway, I left XR when that guy pulled my ID because of what was going on with Roger. Originally, I said I wouldn't leave XR because of what was happening to Roger, but when the same thing, much smaller scale, dilettante activism, manipulation of back in the shadows information, cost me an ID and an application that I really was using, I just said, you know, I'm done. Plus, my XR Orlando group was not growing. I'm writing just for the reader, listeners, to know. I'm kind of promoting something here. In my blog, I'm going to put up a blog post that tells this whole story of my Extinction Rebellion from start to finish. It'll be long, but I'll make it as concise as I can. And it finishes up like with yesterday. And I'll probably have to post up this week.
So when you say long, I've seen what your short 20-page posts are. Are we looking at a book?
Blog posts aren't that long. My blog posts are probably between 500 and 1,000 words, which is not short.
Okay. I get it. It's fine. Short. Somebody asked me to reply to something the other day, and I wrote a 7.5-page response. That's what happens when you do doctoral work.
I know it does. It becomes epidemic. Yeah. I would say this will be, it could be like 1,500 words. I mean, I'm looking at it now, and it could be longer, could be 3,000 for all I know, but it's the full story, and I'm writing it for the blog, but I'm really putting it there because I keep getting asked back in the UK, why did you leave, what made you go, you know, we're sorry to see you go, blah blah blah, so I get tired of telling the story. So between this, if we post it as a podcast, and me having that blog post, there's the whole story.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely be posting this, but that's a good, I guess, full arc for listeners to come to and know to take a look at that. I do want to wrap around to this Hallam thing for one more moment here, if that's all right.
Please.
So the Anti-Defamation League, they're world's foremost expert to really deal with anti-Semitism. I'm having a hard time finding them addressing this Hallam thing. Okay. So that's a flag for me. But They write some articles. They talk about anti-Semitism versus anti-Zionism versus anti-Israel. What does it all mean? What's legit? What's not legit? And so I want to take those comments that were made and compare that to this list to determine if, according to the ADL, Hallam's remarks could be considered anti-Semitic. Does that sound fair?
Sure.
Okay. They say anti-Semitism is a form of prejudice or discrimination directed toward Jews as an individuals or a group. All right. So was the comment a form of prejudice or discrimination against Jews as an individual or a group? What do you think?
I don't think so.
Neither do I.
It was okay. An inflammatory remark about a historical event. Yes. And the historical event was directly centered around Jews. Yeah. But it wasn't only Jews, remember?
That's the thing. So the Holocaust, people typically say, oh, it's the Jews. Well, the fact is, 6 million Jews, and then I think they estimate around 6 million non-Jews as well. So
That's the total number I saw was 11 million.
Yeah, so the Holocaust Memorial that we have here in Portland actually mentions both, and so let's not forget both ends of this. So that is important to acknowledge. I guess the thing that I'm coming across with here is, by definition of anti-Semitism, his comments aren't anti-Semitic.
Well,
are they made? Yeah.
Take the word anti-Semite, okay? And I wrote a post that got quoted that got me booted off. Okay, and I've got it. If you want to read it, it's not that long. it's a message board post. But anyway, I did some digging into what anti-Semite really means, and there's a real sleight of hand that takes place in turning it as an anti-Jewish thing, because the literal meaning of anti-Semite is anyone against any people group that speaks a Semitic language. So it's about language groups. And they were all Eastern Mediterranean language groups, all over half a dozen different parts of that world, different of those parts of the world. But a Semite was a person who spoke any of those Semitic languages. Jews were among them, but they were neither the largest nor the only group who spoke those languages. So literally, anti-Semitic means being against someone who speaks those languages. Now, over time, that got reduced to being against Jews, not because they spoke the language, but just being against Jews as a people group, not a language group. So that's a real sleight of hand. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I guess I could say, from an Orthodox perspective, the Jews as a people group are also a language group because we speak Hebrew.
Correct. But not Semitic. Do you still speak a Semitic? Is Hebrew a Semitic language? I think ancient Hebrew is.
Yeah. So, okay. So there's two types of, there's two main types of Hebrew. There's Ivrit, which is modern Hebrew, which is spoken in Israel today. And then there's what we call Lashon Kodesh, which is the holy tongue, which is biblical Hebrew. Okay. If you go into an Orthodox synagogue, you're not going to hear modern Hebrew. You're only going to hear biblical Hebrew.
What was the vernacular Hebrew in 3 centuries BC?
It's different. I mean, what they have words for ice cream now in modern Hebrew. We don't have that in
biblical Hebrew. I don't mean Hebrew modern because, Hebrew now. I'm talking about 2,500 years ago. What was the vernacular Hebrew then?
That
was it. The biblical Hebrew, the Torah Hebrew.
There is a period where Hebrew usage nearly died, and it needed to be reinvigorated. And so there's a period with, I don't know when that time's in. I do know that Rashi is one of our sages that we refer to as a commentator on the Talmud. He actually is used by historians for understanding Old French and may not translate Old French, because his commentaries he wrote in Old French, and Old French is a dead language today.
Right.
And he uses Hebrew and says, and that French word is such and such. And so they're able to use him to translate the dead language. I don't have as knowledgeable on the vernacular over all of time. I do know that the language that's used to write Torah is Lashon Kodesh. That's the language that we use for prayer and that we read Torah in today.
Right.
Which is, it's different. Grammatically, the structure is different. The words are different. There's different components and how it all ties up. I'm learning Lashon Kodesh. I'm learning how to speak holy tongue. If I go to Israel, they're not necessarily going to understand what I'm saying on the street. But if I go to the ultra-Orthodox community, they'll totally get it.
I understand. I guess I didn't want to suggest that the Jewish people weren't both a language and a people group.
They clearly are. I just want to bring this up for the listener, okay, who maybe he's dialing now for this as a first episode, that the Jewish people and the language still are very much intertwined. It's
absolutely
like in America, a lot of people believe America that the English is the language of America, but there's no official language for this country.
That's true. Not an original language. There's not a people group language for America. There's not an American people group other than the Native Indians.
Exactly. And that's the biggest mentality hoop that somebody needs to go through to really get what's happening on the Jewish end. Because it's a different mentality altogether when you're dealing with a Middle Eastern culture that is steeped in tradition, that still has language, that still has these connections and everything. And so for a lot of people who dial in, most of our metrics show that it's people in the United States. They may not connect with it. So it's important to mention this so that it's that, oh, wait a second, maybe things are different over there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the times they are changing, that's as Dylan wrote and sang, but it's not the change that we think it is. Because yeah. You're exactly right, Jonathan. Most people, it's a conundrum. It's a paradox. Most people know the truth of this and the reality of this climate crisis in the marrow of their bones. They feel that something of that cosmic scale is happening. But it doesn't surface to the consciousness of but a small percentage. Because you have to be aware. It's that right brain, left brain thing. To realize at that marrow level in your bones that something cosmic is going on requires a connection between your right brain and your physical being and presence, your physical presence, that most people tune out. Western civilization has spent 400 years getting us to ignore that. That's what Ian McGilchrist's whole book was about, The Master and His Emissary. That's what his book was about, is how the right brain has been co-opted by the left brain. And the left brain doesn't want to think about things that are scary. So it suppresses them, buries them in the subconscious, and just keeps them there, and just keeps heaping them down there until you just go crazy. Because it's the resonant harmony, to use Lynn's concept, of those two parts of this brain in resonant harmony. Think of the musical metaphor. If you have two voices, two tone deaf singers, two tone deaf musicians, and four out of tune instruments, what kind of music are you going to get?
You're going to get off a cappella.
You're going to get chaos, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You get noise right. With no signal. And that if you break the two halves apart, interestingly enough, they've actually done that medically, and it's almost not noticeable what the difference is. But there are key areas in which if you bifurcate the brain and separate that, there's a corpus callosum that connects them. And the medical community used to, for epileptics with severe epilepsy, the treatment was to cut the corpus callosum between the two halves of the brain. To me, that's worse than a frontal lobotomy. But nevertheless, that's how they treated it. And the observation was by psychologists and medical doctors alike, not any really significant noticeable behaviors except for this. And there would always be something that, who stole my cheese kind of phenomenon. You know, you remember that book that was out a while back? Who moved my cheese?
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. You know, he wasn't talking about cheese at all. He's talking about what, his hat or something? I don't remember. But in any case, it's that kind of dissonance in cognition that just could not happen because that corpus callosum had been severed. Same thing with the frontal lobotomy in women 100 years ago, just to cure the vapors, you know, and the emotions of women. I mean, what misogyny, what kind of brutal misogyny is that? I mean, it's not a whole lot better today, frankly, but that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah. So we're having two main things that we're flowing through in this episode. It's a continuation of us talking about the climate crisis, which that conversation is not going to go away. It's part of an everyday. But then there's also this focus or this highlight that came out where the co-founder said things that people really didn't like to hear about the Holocaust. And my common way is the ADL quotes Nathan Sharansky, who is an Israeli leader and former Soviet refusnik. They identified three D's. And these D's tell you if something that is critical of a nation or critical of a language or critical of anything, if it's really anti-Semitic or not, right? So in the past, we've talked, how can you tell the difference between being against policies Israel has or against something Israel's doing without being anti-Semitic? And these are the three D's that the ADL uses. And actually, the United States has recently adopted similar language. The three D's are demonization, delegitimization, and double standard. If we demonize whoever it is we're talking to, if we're demonizing Israel, if we delegitimize Israel as a state, and then if we give Israel all these things they have to do but their neighbors don't have to do, then it's anti-Semitic. If I was to use the same thing towards Hallam's comments, I don't see it passing those tests. I see that maybe it was poor taste, but it was evocative imagery, and that was the goal. People just didn't want to hear it.
Well, he knew what he was walking into. He sent an email to his colleagues before he went into these interviews and said, hey, things could go crazy in these interviews. I'm liable to say things that are going to be inflammatory because of who's interviewing me.
Yeah.
They knew that he thinks that we're under the thumb, well, under the boot of the Nazi regime, a fascist regime, not necessarily Nazi, but a fascist regime in a modern neo-Nazi kind of thing, not the alt-right, but just a 21st century capitalist fascism. He believes we're under the boot of that fascism. So he was going to talk about that fascism one way or the other. And the questions he was asked took it to the Holocaust. He didn't take it there. The questions he was asked opened that door, and of course he ran right through it.
Yeah, and maybe that's where microaggressions come in. And in order to talk, we have to have everything professionally done. I don't like all that junk. I don't like the idea that I have to worry about political correct all the time. But it seems like in that term, if somebody like that was around, that would have ended up in a different way. I guess
if he made that comment in Idaho at a militia meeting, he would have gotten a standing ovation. I mean, the emotions divide that clearly just on the concept. So, but that's not where he was coming from to either extreme. He was emphasizing evocatively, provocatively, confrontationally, emphasizing a historical truth and saying it. He was literally trying to get across the idea that if you think that was bad, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Which, if people could get past the offense, they could totally see. Now, I understand for some people, maybe it's a trigger in some sense, but that's for those people. And I don't necessarily know what will trigger somebody else. They'll legitimately trigger them. And if something I do causes that, I try to be more cognizant of that. But if it's a public stage, if it's a public forum, we need to censor ourselves on what we should be observing. If I could not handle hearing comments about the Holocaust, maybe I need to not tune into the paper or the news. I mean, that's how much it is part of our everyday of life and history. It's something we're still trying to grapple with. And it's something that's still being discussed and still dissected. And there's certain topics. If you don't want to hear about Trump as president, then don't go outside and don't turn on the radio, don't turn on your phone or anything, just be a hermit under a rock. There's no other way to avoid it. And at a certain point, we have to say, if I'm going to go out there, I have to acknowledge I may come across opinions that I don't like, and that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But working in a college campus, I see individuals all the time where they go out there and they're offended by the news and they tell you that you have to turn off the channel because they're offended by it and it shouldn't be around. Yeah. I'm like, this is a college campus. Get used to opinions you don't like.
Aren't you having a deja vu right now about that period in our cohort where we had that roundabout on safe spaces?
It's absurd.
I
understand if somebody needs treatment and they go to a treatment center, that's a safe space for them because they're being treated for it. But if you're out in the public, there's no such thing as a safe space.
Well, they're not supposed to be, but it's interesting. You don't hear much out of people like, who did we read? Johan Norberg, the Cato fellow who wrote that book about the new optimism. I don't remember the name of the book, but we read a book of his in the cohort. And he's a new optimist. And the better known name is his cohort from the Cato Institute, Steven Pinker. He's the poster child for the new optimism. You don't hear a lot out of them these days because all their statistics are going south. Suicide rates among not quite middle-aged people your age, actually, mid to late millennials, all the way down to kindergarten kids are killing themselves. Suicide rates have turned south. Healthcare is going south. So new optimists like Pinker and Norberg are just kind of twiddling their thumbs and pretending not to notice.
I like to consider myself a realist. The world's going to hell in a handbasket, so I better make sure I'm ready.
Yeah, that's a good climate activist perspective to have. Again, I'm not trying to disparage Extinction Rebellion. It's like any human organization. It's got good and bad. It's got right and wrong. And it's an astonishingly effective movement in the right direction. It has its limits, but it's a surprisingly effective movement.
It seems also, like what they've accomplished in Europe and in the UK is about what I've seen Antifa accomplish in Portland.
Well, I don't know. Antifa's kind of a mystery to me. I mean, their anti-fascism has good meaning. But the problem is the violent approach that they supposedly are taking is a little dubious because they tend to disrupt progressive events with violent action. So you almost wonder how much of what they're doing isn't really Antifa, but agent provocateur mole kind of behavior. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a legitimate concern. In Portland, there have been arguments about how violent they are and yada yada. But then when you look behind the reports, you find out, oh, the reporter has his bias.
Yeah.
And then when you get the story about, oh, such and such, they were mistreated so horribly and they had this accident. And then when you look into the facts, like, oh, they were there throwing racial slurs at the Hispanic individual. There's so much we're missing, but because of how Antifa dresses and because of what ends up on the news, people make assumptions, and that's unfortunate. It is an amazing organization that really has a horrible marketing program.
that's pretty astute, actually.
And I see in some cases Extinction Rebellion struggles with that when it comes to taking root in America.
They do, and I don't. There are 60 chapters in the U.S., and there are at least 8 or 10 around Portland, Seattle.
Oh yeah, I see their stuff. I know there's chapters here, but when it comes to marketing, they need someone.
Yeah. So that's why. Well, the reason they aren't successful at marketing is because there's no national coordination that would let them get there. It all has to be done locally because the national organization has a good, well, they have a crappy website, and they will promote nationalist level ideas, but they don't do anything to make it. They just put announcements on their website. We're participating in the global climate strike. We're participating in the October Rebellion, but they don't tell you what to do, how to do it. They provide no framework for the activism across the organization. They're just kind of a cheerleading function, you know. I think frankly that their organization is there to keep XR under wraps. I don't trust them, I'll be honest with you. They gaslighted me within 2 months of me joining the organization and would not let me near national. You know what they blamed it on? They said that in my social media posts about my chapter, I was proselytizing my Christian faith. Well, two things. It was false. I asked for any example. They never gave me one. Show me one post in any Facebook post or other social media where I was proselytizing my Christian faith. Because the most I ever did was say, this is what this would mean, or this is how this would look to a Christian within a larger dialogue or within a larger context that had nothing to do with Christianity. So it was more of an apologetic, just an explanation of what the Christian view would be. I was never pushing anyone to take that view. But they did not give me a single example. They just stopped talking to me. So that was their excuse.
You know, now it's making me rack my head here trying to think. There, I remember, I'm going to tell you this. I remember that there's one post that came out as XOR Orlando. I looked at Tasha, my wife, and I said, this is going to get him in trouble. Just from being a former insider on the outside and seeing how everything works. I'm trying to remember the exact post, but
I'd like to know where that happened.
It's something that was not, it's not proselytizing. It flat out isn't. But it's something that could potentially be taken out of context. And it sounds like it did happen. It maybe my cynicism is just too much a reality that is the post. But yeah. It was early on, and it was one little comment, and I was like, no, I get what he's saying, but somebody's going to get offended.
Well, somebody did, maybe. I mean, that may be the one, and they couldn't find it. Who knows? But anyway, that was their zinger that they used to bring me, or to marginalize me, basically, to not being effective beyond my. But there was. There's a line that I use, and I'm going to try to think of where it is because I'd like to read it to you. I was trying to explain what it's like to try to raise an activist movement in Orlando on an issue like climate change. So let me see if I can find that because it's a really good line, I think. You tell me if it's not a good line or not. It's in the book. I'm writing a book. It's really my dissertation. I said I was going to write my dissertation as a more readable book. That's what I'm doing. I'm going to publish it in the Kindle app that you can put in Word to write a book. It's an add-on to Word.
When you say readable for whom?
Well, it's still going to be scholarly in the sense that I'm going to have a lot of notes. Okay. But I'm going to I'm going to make more accessible language in saying what I'm saying. And I'm not going to go off in as many directions. I'm not going to go as deep into the math. I'm not going to go as deep into politics. You know, I'm going to make those points, but far more succinctly and hopefully less abstruse language. I'd appreciate a read when I get it done if you would. And in fact, I had an idea that when I was about halfway through that I might pass it to you and see if you want to join me in contributing, because at the end of each section, I'm going to have a Christian postscript. You know, I'm going to say, if you want to look at this as a Christian, this is how to look at it. But I won't mention that. You know, it's just a postscript at the end of each chapter. What I would like to have is a Judeo-Christian postscript. But you're the one to write that. So if you're interested, I'll pass it along when I've done 3 or 4 chapters, and you can see if you'd like to jump in on that. And then we could co-op.
Send me an info, I'll take a look, and I'll probably have to get some input and everything to make sure I'm properly representing the Judeo end of it.
That's fine. But anyway, let me see if I can find this thing I was looking for. Get rid of this. Bear with me here for just a second.
Totally fine. While you're looking into that, there was one post that occurred on the XOR Orlando on Facebook, and it was in May. And you did plenty of disclaimer afterwards, but you said the phrase "Christians, where do you stand?" I don't think this is the post in question, but I've noticed that whenever there's a movement or an organization, the second you say the word Christian, everybody is so.
It's true.
I can't find any other post, not easily, but I do remember telling Tasha one time, like, somebody's going to misconstrue this.
Well, I have.
But, you know, the same thing was like, it's Terry doing Extinction Rebellion. Somebody has to get offended. It's just how it is. I mean, you're very to the point with what you write. And the whole climate crisis thing, for some reason, is a huge political debate. So you're not gonna mince words, or you're gonna say it how it is, and somebody's gonna get offended.
Yeah, that's unfortunately true, but that's where it is. And I don't know how to keep that from being the case, you know?
Yeah. Well, at least you can say they cared enough to restart them for what you wrote.
It's actually my blog post that'll be coming out sometime this week where I'm telling this whole story. Let me just read the sentence to you. Okay. I like this. You made it. You tell me. Growing a climate activism movement in the Orlando area where escaping from reality is hardwired into the DNA of the local economy, politics, culture, and ethos is like selling barbed wire sandwiches with a raw beef wrap and au jus dipping sauce at a vegan picnic.
That's a very image driven there.
I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, being a vegetarian myself, I'm like, oh.
Yeah, exactly. It's a harsh image, but it was that hard. 125 people on my email distribution list, which I built up from 11. When I left last week, I had 125 people on my email list. And out of those 125 people, throughout the 9-10 months that I was in XR, all the events I went to, all the meetings I had, all the talks I gave, and there weren't that many. I'm not bragging. Could have done many more. But anyway, what little activism I actually did, I never had more than 6 people show up with me. And even those 6 were volatile. There were maybe 3 or 4 who were pretty regular for a while, and then they'd drift away. You know, maybe it was me. Lord knows, I'm no charismatic leader, follow me guy. You know, it's like you say, I'm going to say what I think and mean it when I say it. Whether I'm right or wrong, I'll find out later. You know, a lot of time. But I try to know what I'm talking about and talk about what I know, at least. But there is, I have to say, there's a little bit of that same Roger Hallam lightning rod in me. I have the same worldview. And the fact that people just don't even want to think about that and would rather just pretend it isn't so, it's just, I'm going, that just is that's my hot button. Deliberate ignorance, willful ignorance is just, I just can't stand that. And Jim Bendel is much the same way. He has another paper, aside from the deep adaptation paper, where he says, look, these are the things that you're going to come up against in trying to communicate with people about this. And he has a list of like 12 things. They're really good. All of this is going to be in my new group on Facebook, which is called The End Signs. Go figure.
Yes. You'd mentioned that. So
I think I sent you an invitation to join it, by the way.
Yes, I got the invite and I've just been sick. But 2 points of maintenance without. First one for listeners, when they're hearing about this blog post that's coming out. It has come out already. You're listening to this recording after it was recorded. So there's that delay. So if you're waiting for it, take a look at the prior posts. It's already there. And the second one, the Jim Bendel, I pulled him up. I looked at what he was doing and everything, and I'm kind of at a loss. It's like he helped organizations prepare for incremental change. And then he said, what if there's a catastrophic change and everybody shuts him out? You there, Terry?
Yeah, I'm here. That's exactly what happened.
That's like, I read it from what he's doing is logical. If you're telling companies how to adapt for incremental change, they're like, well, what if something catastrophic happens? How should we deal with that? That's logical to me. Of course we should know what to do. That's the thing I don't want to hear. So they don't want to hear it. They could still prepare.
Exactly. Prepare for the worst. Even if it doesn't come, you're better off.
Yeah.
There's another guy, and I have the article. He's a consultant, kind of academic, and he's kind of a specialist on this stuff, climate change and ecosystem collapse and 6 mass extinction and all that stuff. And he got a call from someone who wanted to bring him in to speak. And he thought it was a speaking engagement. I have this article. It'll probably be in my blog post. And he had people who wanted to, he just got contacted, and they offered him like the equivalent of a year's salary. to come and speak to this group. And he said, oh, well, hey, yeah, I'll do that. I've kind of not done as much speaking lately because it's kind of arduous to do it. But yeah, for that kind of money, I'll do it. So he agreed, and they booked his flight, and they, you know, brought him into a hotel where their offices were located and put him up in the hotel. Next day, he goes to the place where he thinks he's going to have like a convention center, he thought, where he was going to go and have this talk where he'd speak to dozens, if not hundreds, or even a thousand or so people. He ended up in a green room, and then they came and said, okay, it's time for you to speak now. And they took him into a room with four people.
Okay.
And he recognized them when he saw them. And he wouldn't name them because he was under a non-disclosure. But I think it was four, might have been six, but it was less than a dozen people. And they had brought him there. It came out as they began asking him questions to draw out of him how they, as multi-billionaire tech tycoons, should prepare for the sixth mass extinction, the climate crisis, and the ecosystem collapse, and the collapse of civilization as we know it. They had brought him there to pick his brain on how they should spend their money to be prepared. And he answered their questions for them and took his money and went home. And, whether Elon Musk's, you know, he has license or permission from the federal government to launch, I think the number is 11,000 satellites. And he's asked for a second round that'll take him up to like 30,000 satellites. Most people don't know this. It was in the news, you know, it's in the congressional record, I think. But he's got permission for 11,000. You remember that string of pearl satellites he sent up a few months back, 60 satellites? Everybody just kind of, you know, it was back page news, and everybody just kind of, oh, that's cool. Went right on about their lives. And supposedly it's only about building a 5G communication network around the planet by satellite, right? Supposedly that's what it's for. But I'm going, wait a minute. Would you spend that much money to send that many satellites up if you were only going to telecommunicate? I don't think so. I don't think so. Telecommunication may be one of its key functions, but I doubt if it's even the primary function, much less the only function. There's an architecture of technology in space evolving that I think has more to do with the 1% escape plan and exit strategy than it has to do with giving everybody 5G communication. But that's me. I'm just a conspiracy kook. What do I know?
Well, it's easy for you to give that impression online, but then when you talk with you, interact with you, you work on a dissertation project together, you kind of learn that there's some knowledge there behind that.
Well, thank you. I like to think so. So most of our colleagues from the cohort, by the way, including Lynn, have basically detached from me since the cohort. I think primarily because of the XR stuff. Now, Paul Ruddock's an exception. He and I have stayed in touch like you and I have. And he hears me out, you know, and we share and commiserate just electronically. I can't think of another person in there except maybe Paul Jones. We just don't talk about it, but we stay kind of in occasional contact. But Jennifer, you know, I don't want to name names, but Lynn himself, much to my dismay, he even said to me, now you remember him talking about the good church, get out of doors, G-O-O-D church, get out of doors, and remember ministering to your zip code? Remember those kind of ideas, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I asked him, I've been kind of pushing his buttons on why he's not more open. I haven't read Rings of Fire yet in its published version, and I need to do that. But I really don't see him pushing the church as hard as I think he should. He does it in his books a little bit, but he needs to be a voice in the front lines of this climate issue. Whether he's in a group or not, if it's not bullet number one in his talks and in his books, he's not living up to the mission that's in front of the church, I don't think. And I've kind of been pushing him on that. And he pushed him on the zip code thing and the get out of doors thing in a message, or may have been an email. No, it was in a message. And he basically said, has nothing to do with the gospel to do any of that. The gospel is done around a table. And I get that he comes from that, but that was such a glib, dismissive response that I was really crestfallen to get it, to be honest. But anyway, I sent him another update, and I tried to put an olive branch out there and say, look, I sense more dissonance than I want in our relationship, and I want to get that resonant harmony back. Help me here. I just left XR. Help me think about what comes next. You know, I haven't heard from him yet, but anyway, this is going public, isn't it? Oh, well.
Yeah, well, but by the time people listen to this, it'll be a few months, because we have our series in a row. So by then, you'll have an update for us. But thinking on that engagement, I remember there was a little thing on Facebook where he said something, you said something, he said something back, and it was very much along those lines. And I guess the way you present things sometimes can be very off-putting. So I understand the concern with that. But my response is, right now, you and I are having this conversation. Well, I don't know where you're doing this because we're on Skype, but I'm at my table. And I've had plenty of conversations to this like at my table, because on Shabbat, we get around the table, we have food, and we discuss the issues. And if the issues can't be discussed, then there's something wrong with the table.
I agree, totally. I'm not trying to say that bringing the table part of his ministry focus into the conversation was wrong. I'm just saying it was wrong to reduce the gospel to that.
Well, and coming from an Orthodox Jewish perspective, my hesitation on gospel and how that works in the larger scope and everything, I guess my response is still, we can have these conversations at the table.
Sure.
Maybe we need to invite somebody that's more discussion worthy. maybe that's my biggest jab at the contemporary postmodern Christian culture, is it seems to be a lot of fluffing of feathers in the mega preachers and not a lot of depth to what they say. And I'm not saying Lynn's guilty of that. By all means, I think he's deep. But I'm saying that I see that as a danger that contemporary Christianity has, which makes it kind of a laughingstock among non-Christians.
How many times, I can think numerous, I wouldn't want to try to count them, how many times he pointed out that Jesus' ministry, first and foremost, was healing. Then he taught, then he preached. Right? I mean, that's how he prioritized it. Well, the pandemic, universal disease today is solastalgia. Now, I know that's a mouthful of words, and if you don't know the meaning, it's basically a new word that has been coined and has been adopted that describes the despair and the grief you feel when you lose your home. Your house burns down, you have a homesickness that's just profound. If you have to leave your homeland, you have a sickness for your home that's profound. And what are Christians? We are strangers in a strange land. This land is not our home. Our home is up elsewhere, right? I don't know the Jewish perspective on that. I'd be interested. But anyway, this is not our home. Well, it's not anybody's home anymore, because we're all going to die. Christians and Jews, I think, know that there's another land waiting for us. But if you're not walking in some kind of faith, and I don't, you know, maybe there's something that works in Islam. I don't know. But if you're not walking some kind of faith that goes beyond this life, there's no home but here. And it's gone. I mean,
so that's fascinating, actually. Today,
what we're experiencing today is what was baked into the atmosphere 30 years ago. There's 30 years of climatic effect that hasn't even started manifesting yet, that there's no way to get away from. People don't get that.
You just diagnosed something that I've been racking my brain about for a while now. So we have our main monotheisms, which is Judaism, which then became Islam and Christianity, right? So we have those big three. Whether or not you consider Catholicism part of it, it's your own personal issue, but I lump it together just for simplicity's sake. So then you get outside of there and like, what's the big faiths of the world? Well, there's Chinese popular religion, there's this, that, but it mostly boils down to a form of Buddhist Hinduism, which is abdication of the physical.
Exactly.
And that makes sense now why I'm seeing more and more atheist individuals jump onto mindfulness meditation, which is Buddhism wrapped with a pretty bow.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to have some sort of faith, and if atheism is your faith, it's your faith. But the atheist that I work with, she said that she was religious enough to baptize her kid, just to play the odds.
Buying that insurance policy.
Exactly. So I think if people really think about it, they're put in a position where they either have to abdicate the physical realm or look for a future physical realm. Most people are just too busy beating to whatever music's playing on the radio that day and trying to survive their day at work and not try to picture a bigger image. And then before you know it, you turn around 30 years has gone by.
Yeah, well, if you think back to my dissertation, and just in talking about it, whether we read them or not, in my dissertation, one of the fundamental distinctions I drew was between being and presence. Your presence, instant to instant, is the manifestation of the timelessness of your being. You've existed in the mind of God before time began, and you will exist in the mind of God to the end of time. And your being is that eternal, immortal identity of who you are. Your presence is just a manifestation of that minute, that being through time, nanosecond by nanosecond. So that being and presence mention was crucial to my dissertation, and I continue to lean on it heavily. And if you don't believe in that being, you only believe in presence, materialistic, physical, manifest physical presence, then there's nothing else. You're at a real binary tipping point there. Because if there's only physical presence, materialism, what is meaning? Language comes noise.
Yeah.
There's just no meaning. It's nihilism.
You just described 2001 A Space Odyssey to me. I could have saved 2 hours of my life there. Just noise.
But look up that word, nostalgia. S-O-L-A, and then like nostalgia.
Okay, we'll have to take a look at that. So what's interesting is how you tie it on that little component there in Lashon Kodesh. So in Biblical Hebrew, we have a phrase. It's the identity of a Jew. It's our mantra, so to say. It's Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elkeinu, Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, God is our king, God is one. Right? That's the simple understanding. The thing, though, is that most people attribute hear and listen to be the same thing. Oh, you listen. But no, it's not. Shama means to hear. It does not mean to listen. It means specifically, oh, I heard that, not I am actively listening to it. So I think it's interesting that the trademark mantra for a Jew, what our faith is about, is that we heard it, but we're not necessarily actively listening to that.
Right, right. It's almost like, this is probably a very poor analogy, actually. We're always hearing what I think is really the dissipated voice of God. It's the background noise of the cosmos. He never stopped creation. He never stopped speaking it into and out of existence. And it's never silent. We just hear it as noise.
It's the resonant harmony of creation.
Exactly. Only hear it as background static. I mean, I'm increasingly inclined. I just like that idea that what we think of as background static is still the voice of God singing creation. We just don't listen to it.
So there's this one book I'm going to recommend to you. And it's probably going to throw you for a loop at first because it's a Jewish book, right? It's by an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. I want you to take a look at it to engage this level of it. It's called Jewish Meditation by Rabbi Arya Kaplan. Rabbi Arya Kaplan passed in the 80s, but before passing, he wrote this book, Jewish Meditation. And It's about meditation. Yeah, the book, it's called Jewish Meditation. The most common version of the book has this picture of a purple wall with rooms inside rooms and everything. It's the basic, simplest version of what Jewish meditation is. But he talks about that static and how it takes time to practice meditation to get to the next levels, to hone in or fine tune into that static so that it's no longer a static for you, but you're in the motion with it.
Yeah. You move from dissonance to harmony.
Exactly. That's so very much again, Rabbi? Arya. So that's A-R-Y-E-H. Arya Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N.
And A-R-Y-E-H, Arya Kaplan.
A-R-Y-E-H, yeah, Kaplan.
All right, got
and the reason I'm saying it slowly is because I'm scanning my bookshelf looking for the book at the same time. But he just tried to write a practical book for the average Orthodox Jew who wants to meditate or learn that meditation is actually a very ancient Jewish tradition, mindfulness meditation in particular, in fact. But he talks about the harmony of creation that's going on and how meditation helps us become in sync instead of out of sync with that harmony.
Right. That's cool. I like that.
So there's a lot of Kabbalistic thought that goes into it. So I thought you might find that rather fascinating, if nothing less than just a semiotic lens, because everything he's talking about is just loaded with metaphor.
Cool. Very cool. Well, we've gone 2 hours, dude.
I know. We're calling this one part two. So, you know, when you're listening to season two of Semiobites, you've had 4 episodes of Extinction Rebellion in one way or another.
Well, for the near future, my focus is going to be more on deep adaptation, Jim Bendel, mm-hmm. and my book. My last official activist event is going to be this Friday, which is the global climate strike in harmony, in solidarity with Fridays for Future, which is Greta Thunberg's movement. And there'll probably be 300 people down at City Hall on Friday from maybe half a dozen different groups. I'll probably be the only XR person there. But here's my costume this time. I've never taken a costume before, but this time I have a white lab coat.
Yeah.
Like a scientist. It's got the Extinction Rebellion Hourglass logo on the pocket. And on the back, it's got the Extinction Rebellion demand number one, which is tell the truth. And I'll have a poster that's the CO2 chart over the last 100,000 years that shows this hockey stick straight up spike over the last 400 years. That's the poster I'll have with me, the scientific perspective.
Got it. So we've had in this season 4 episodes of climate change, Extinction Rebellion, that type of thing. We've even talked rights and responsibilities and the idea of shooter versus terrorist. And we're aiming for 9 episodes. So we've got a few more, but just to give listeners, first off, we recorded this first week of December. So when you're looking for Terry's works, look around that time frame. Second off, Terry and I have, we're taking Semiobites in a altered direction. It's going to be more of a organic approach where we're not trying to be as sit down, write the post, so much regulation that really inhibited us and slowed us up with our recording and publishing process. We're going to make it a little easier on both of us. We're going to get together. We're going to discuss a topic that one of us has researched, or neither of us, or both of us. It really depends. And then there may or may not be blog posts to follow that up. So those are some changes to look forward to. But I actually do have a request, Terry. I've got at least one more episode I want to do on climate change.
Okay.
But I want to go back in time with this one, and I want to talk about the climate change in regards to the flood.
Okay.
So that's a little bit out there, and we'll have time to prep and everything, if any prep's needed. But I found out some really interesting information from a Jewish perspective regarding the flood and catastrophic climate change and everything, and that it's talked about in Torah, which is something that I wasn't previously aware of. So.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, and it seems like a perfect tie-in with all the other things we've been talking about. So yeah,
that's fascinating. Well, John, so, it's been real, and I love talking with you about this stuff. Let's do it again soon.
Yeah, definitely. All right, talk to you later, Terry.
Good night. Goodbye. Bye.
Send questions, comments, and suggestions to semiobytes@gmail.com. SemioBytes is a podcast co-hosted by Yedbrick and Semio City that answers Semitic questions via Semiach analysis by addressing misunderstandings to build a bridge of shalom between Judaism and Christianity. SemioBytes is a component of the Track 2 dissertation process at Portland Seminary for Jonathan Esterman and Terry Rankin.